floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senors and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett, your old pal Chris Shiflett, and you are listening to another edition of Walking the Floor. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hope everything is great in your world. It's been a busy week. I went out and played at this kind of a Bernie Sanders campaign event out in Las Vegas over the weekend, last weekend, and that was super fun. He wasn't there, but there were some campaign surrogates getting up and speaking, and I got up and played some music, and a bunch of students got up and sang, and it was at this street fair thing they do in Vegas called First Friday. It was super fun. Ozo Motley headlined it, but by the time they played, I was already on a Southwest flight back home to sunny Southern California. But it was cool. It's a cool event. Cool to see people out there. I'm always kind of struck by the difference between sort of how Sanders supporters are portrayed and then who you actually meet when you go to these things. And I've been to a few of these things, and it just seems like a bunch of regular folks, not a bunch of rigid ideologues or Bernie bros or whatever, you know, people like to say. And I know even me talking about this right now is probably upsetting some of you listeners. I get it. I see the comments on my social media when I post about this stuff. You know, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about all that. I think it's a little strange. I think if you know anything about me, you probably already know that my podcast and my social media outlets are really just kind of like extensions of myself and just places where I talk about whatever my opinions are, whatever's going on with in my life. And I'm never going to not talk politics. I know people love to smash that over your head. Shut up and play. You're a musician. We don't care. I always like to remind people you're free to not follow me. You're free to not listen to this podcast. I get it. If it bothers you that much and you can't handle somebody with a different opinion than yourself, please, by all means, just stop listening. But I mean, for that matter, you can comment whatever you want on my social media stuff. If you want to call me a dumb communist or whatever, feel free. But you might want to, kind of take the time to think about what you're saying, because it seems to me, just from looking at the comments on any of the Sanders stuff that I post, there's a real, real heavy misunderstanding out there between the differences between, socialism and communism and democratic socialism and sort of what the policy positions are that Bernie Sanders even supports, you know? So, I don't know. Get on your Google machine and read up on it, because these are important differences. And you know, it's important to remember that we already have a lot of, socialist policies here in this country and have for a long time, Social Security and the VA and the police force and all the rest of it, man. It's already here, people. It's nothing new. It's pretty old. I think the most annoying comments to me are the ones that that try to hold up countries like Venezuela as some sort of example of how socialism fails. It never works. Look at Venezuela, without really looking at in the context of Western, especially the United States, Western countries meddling in their economies and disrupting their economies, and really just going around the globe and disrupting anybody, any country with democratically elected governments who our government disagrees with. I mean, come on, people, know your history. Silly shit. Anyhow, that's my political rant. Hope it didn't put too much of you off. I try not to get angry about the stuff. I try not to even really engage with people online. I think it's just silly. It's like playing whack-a-mole. But yeah, don't expect me to shut the fuck up and play, because I ain't never gonna do it, people. All right, let's pay some bills. Zounds.com. Did you know that nobody makes the best gear from the best brands more affordable than Zounds.com? You never have to pay full price all at once when you buy from Zounds, and they're cool, man. The whole dang company is staffed with musicians that understand what musicians want and need, and they're a wealth of information and knowledge. So if you're looking to buy some strings or something like a guitar or a new microphone or anything at all music gear related, get on over to Zounds.com today. Zounds.com. All right, let's get to the interview.
Yeah! Thank you!
All right, I feel like I owe Mr. Delbert McClinton an apology because in my mind, I thought that I had already posted this. I don't know why I thought that. I think I must be going senile. But this interview with Delbert is from Americana Fest last September. He was getting like a Lifetime Achievement Award that week, and it was really cool to talk to him. Obviously, you know Delbert McClinton. He's a legend of roots, a guy who's been making records, seems like, forever. And his music, you know, it's like... What is his music? It's everything. It's blues, it's country, it's rock and roll, it's R&B, man. It's got all those flavors in there mixed up in a big Texas stew. So I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. This is Mr. Delbert McClinton on Walking the Floor. Check, 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 check. Are we recording? Going, all right. Good morning, Nashville. How's your Americana Fest going? My name's Chris Shiflett. I wanted to welcome you guys to a special live taping of my podcast, Walking the Floor. I need your help this morning because I want all of you folks to pretend that it's not 10:30 in the morning. We're not in a brightly lit hotel ballroom area. And just close your eyes and imagine it's like... you know, we're in like a smoke-filled Texas honky-tonk somewhere, and the music's playing, and the smell of beer's coming up through your nose, and you get the idea. What I'm asking is for you guys to be a little more rowdy than the environment would suggest. Can you do that, Nashville? All right. Well, so, you know, I've had the pleasure over the years of interviewing all sorts of legendary artists, and this morning is absolutely no exception. Please welcome Mr. Delbert McClinton. Hey, buddy. Welcome, sir. And how is your Americana Fest going?
Well, you know, as odd as it might sound, this is a whole new world for me.
Really?
I've spent a lifetime not doing this. Right. You know, I've spent a lifetime playing beer joints from one end of hell to the other, you know? And I've loved every minute of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no way to make a living. But but it's you get, you know, if you like to play music, you want to play music.
Sure.
So... 8 nights a week, you know.
That's how we do it. Twice on Sunday.
I did it, but I don't do that no more. Yeah. No, I. Right now, I gonna make enough music to satisfy the Jones.
Well, at this point in your life and career, how do you decide when it's time to make a new record? Like, are you just sort of always compiling songs? Like, what is that process for you?
Well, you know, in the last 7 years, here's what's happened, and it's been one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me. This band, I've had a whole new band. I'd say a whole new band. 6 years ago, you know, being in a band is you don't have to stay with them, right? You're not like you're married.
Right. So man, I thought it was like you were married.
I had some guys, I had some playing with some guys that started getting so much better gigs than I, you know, I couldn't pay them.
Sure.
So I had to put another band together. That's an odd sounding thing to say, put another band together. But that's what it was. And which wasn't a big deal because I'm surrounded by great people.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you. I wanted to find out if you do keep a band together and if that band plays on your records or if you hire guys every time.
No. We're family.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I mean, I work with the people I admire the most in this world.
Right. So your band is on your latest record, Tall, Dark, and Handsome.
Oh, yeah. It's my band. And a few additions, you know. I'm sure you've seen Jim Hoke around here. He's a freak.
Do tell. I'm not familiar with Mr. Hoke.
Well, he plays anything you can put in front of him better than anybody else.
I love those guys.
And
I hate those guys.
I hate those guys, too.
They make me feel lazy.
He's fun to hate because you can talk. You can't. It's endless to talk about it. First time I saw him last night, he was playing tenor. Next time I saw him, he was playing Barry. Next time I saw him, he was playing steel guitar. And if you saw him on the street and talked to him, you'd just think he's another dick. You know? You know, I mean, you wouldn't see it, and even when he's doing it, you can't see it in his face.
Yeah.
Enough about him. Let's talk about me.
Well, so okay. Well, so, but what is that process like? When do you just get the itch? Like it's time to go make a new record?
No, what it's going it? On all the time.
Right.
I can put horn parts to the hum of the city.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
It's just going on. And these guys that I'm working with, we decided to see if we could write something together, a couple of us. Wrote two of the best songs I've ever written in my life. So we did it again and wrote three more. And I've got a place in Mexico, beautiful place where you couldn't be anymore sitting on top of the world looking down on everybody.
Well,
no, not everybody, looking down on the beautiful city. Anyway, we go there a week or 10 days and just write songs and enjoy being alive.
And how does that influence the creative process for you? How does that influence your songwriting?
Well, we don't have to. Nobody's going to interrupt us. One thing that happens.
Right.
You don't have to put a different hat on for every joke that comes around the corner, you know.
Right.
So it's a freedom.
Yeah.
And it's a freedom with great fellowship, you know. We all love each other. And it's hard to come by.
You don't often get that in this business where nobody's looking at the clock on the wall.
Yeah, well, these days you don't. You know, used to, it wasn't about the money
the glory, the fame, the Lamborghinis, the reality TV show.
Getting somebody's attention by having a wardrobe malfunction.
Right.
Or catching on fire. When MTV came along, this is what I saw over a period of time. Being a good lyricist or singer took a quick back seat to dancing.
Right. It became more about the spectacle
and
less about
the spectacle.
The song.
And boy, we're in a world of spectacle. It's not as bad as it was a few years ago, but it's a lot worse.
Right. Yeah. Where did you grow up in Texas?
Of the Plains, Lubbock, Texas, the High Plains. It's called, in the history books, it's called the Llano Estacado, which means staked plains, because the Spaniards who came through that part during the discovery time. It's so flat forever that if you look real hard, you can see the back of your head. People had to pile dried buffalo shit, as a point of reference.
Really?
Yeah. The Llano Estacado. Look it up. It's an interesting story.
Why was Texas at that time when you were growing up, why was it such a hub of the blues scene? Why were so many of those artists around Texas at that time?
I was going to ask if you knew.
You're supposed to be the expert, man.
Well, how am I supposed to know?
Well, like, who was around? Like, who did you see growing up? Who did you get to go see live?
Okay, I moved. Well, I didn't, because I moved away from Lubbock when I was 11 years old.
Right.
And that was about 2 or 3 years before Buddy Holly. So when somebody from Lubbock was the biggest guy in the world, really made me about 10 feet tall.
Right, sure.
And I said, well, fuck, can you say that? No.
You can say whatever you want. This is a podcast. There's no rules.
I only say things that's necessary for punctuation.
You're trying to create the spectacle.
I am.
Yeah.
I this may be the only shot I got.
Well, so who were the guys that you were
seeing? Well, you know, I was living in Fort Worth by 1951.
Right.
So I heard everybody. I heard everybody from the 40s when I was a kid. It's still my favorite music.
Right.
Johnny Mercer.
And there's some of that sound on your new record.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like, who would you say were your sort of primary influences in those days?
Oh, man. Nat King Cole. Anything Johnny Mercer did. Johnny Mercer and the Pied Pipers. Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, of course, without saying. But Hank Williams is God.
Yeah.
He's never been surpassed in and likely never will, in his honest, his phrasing. I've worked for years, I've tried for years to understand his phrasing. I can't do it and breathe.
Well, he's like one of, you know, like so many great singers of any genre. You realize when you try to cover their song that a huge part of what makes the song great is them.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it is, because, you know, especially, pardon me, if you're the writer, because you know where all the emotion goes.
Right.
Without having to be told, or if it's something you hear, and this is the way I've always done. If I hear a song and I think I can make it mine, I'm not afraid to sing it.
Right.
And I've always felt that way about, I want to make a record with songs like Paper Moon, you know?
Yeah.
And Hard-Hearted Hannah.
Why did you get the music bug when you were a kid? What was family?
I have
was
no
environment,
idea,
friends?
Nobody in my family. My daddy, he was a little kind of old vaudeville looking tap dancer, you know?
Really?
Well, not really, but the little bit he did was really good.
Right, right.
And when he would do it, I would just, it thrilled me so much. And it's the same rhythm I've got.
Hmm.
So that's the only connection that I'm aware of.
Right.
Can y'all hear me when I'm not talking on a mic?
Yeah, is everything working out there?
I'm pretty much a loud mouth.
Well, so when did you start playing music yourself? Like, what was your first instrument? Was it harmonica?
I came home from school one day, about 1952 or 3. We lived in a duplex in Fort Worth, shotgun duplex, you know. And I had two brothers. And I came in the front door with my school books, and I heard somebody in my house singing a Hank Williams song and playing a guitar. Well, I dropped everything I had and started through. And between the kitchen and the dining room was an arch, you know. And this long, lanky, oil-field-working, hard-hat guy was sitting on his ass, leaning against the wall with his feet up on the other side, playing and singing a Hank Williams song.
In your house?
In my house.
Who was this man?
His name was Ray Harden.
Why was he in your house?
He was a friend of my brother's.
Okay.
And this is the first time I'd ever
thought
seen
maybe
him.
He just wanted
he had a little
Martin
with a hole in it about that big.
Mm.
He told me he stepped on it while he was drunk. And that made him even a bigger hero.
Right.
You know, this guy was John Wayne gone to seed.
Right. So that was like your lightning bolt moment?
That was,
I want to do
well,
that.
Well, that was when I wanted to learn to play guitar. I never learned, but I pull and jerk guitar is what I play.
Sometimes that's all you need.
Well, I can write that way, but yeah. With these new guys in the band, getting back to it, they know more chords than I do.
Yeah.
And so Bob Britt, who's a genius guitar player, he just starts playing, and I start with a melody. Maybe words, maybe just a... And in a little while, we got a song.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of fun.
That's the magic.
Yeah.
When did you start playing?
And you can do it sitting on your ass.
Yeah. We could do it right now if we were so inclined.
This is kind of what this is.
That's right.
Bouncing back and forth off each other.
I know at least three chords. That's a starting point.
I know three, too.
You gotta start a band, man. All right, so when did you
okay.
When did you go from like strumming in your house to actually getting out playing in front of people?
I'll tell you the first. I don't know which was first, Ray Harden or this. There was a place back then. This was in the early 50s, and the woods were not very far away. Right. Now it's
Walmart.
Yeah. So it was, you rode your bicycle everywhere.
Yeah.
You and your gang. And we would go to the, we'd get BB guns and go to the woods. At this one particular year, there was this infestation of rats. Well, we'd go down there and camp out, spend the night, and shoot rats. Mm. Because you just had to sit there and shoot. And there was this thorn bush about that thorn's about this long. One guy said, "Hey, man, I'm going to try this." put a BB gun and stabbed one to death, you know? So that's what we did. That's right. What we were doing. Okay, so...
The music was a step up at that point.
Yeah, we were... It was still a lot of Perry Como at this time, right. You know. Right. We had to come across the field, and then this was... It was from the last road in the city, you got to go across the tracks, and the tracks, what they call the hump. And it's a switching yard where they make up trains, so you come in, and then there's about 10 or different tracks.
Yeah.
Well, one of the most beautiful things of growing up then, you slept with your windows open, and you could hear them, and I was a mile away. You could hear those tracks. Put you right to sleep, man. You can count on it, man. Anyway, we had to come back across this field and across the tracks. And if the tracks were crowded, we had to go through a duct.
Right.
Cockroaches that big in there. But, you know, we'd hurry. Anyway, in order to get back, before you get to the tracks, you got to come across the field. And there's a black barbecue joint out there on Stove Foundry Road. And I heard, get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. And it just stopped me in my tracks. And that's when it happened.
Your rat hunting days were over.
Rat hunting days were over.
Okay, so did you, was that where you first started playing out live? Like
No. That's when I started. I didn't have a guitar. I didn't have a dime.
Right.
So, both of my brothers knew guys with guitars.
Right.
Ray Harden, I did never see much of, so I didn't ever. But Joe Don Sanders, my other brother's friend, he had a beautiful Gibson guitar. Mm. And he'd come over and he'd play and sing a little bit. And that's where I learned the E and A and B7.
Yeah, yeah. That's all you need.
All you need is a B7.
Yeah.
And I started learning to play on that. So me and my brother, his just older than me, we started saying, we've got to find a guitar because we both wanted to play. Well, we found one. It was a K. Mm. You know about a K?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, we paid
three. Those are like sought after vintage guitars now.
Yeah, well, we paid $3.50 for it.
Right. Yeah, was that like a Sears catalog guitar?
I don't know where it came from, but the neck looked more like a bow.
Right.
You couldn't tune it.
Yeah.
I mean, I bled and bled.
You had to really want it to play.
Well, I did.
Yeah.
I don't know. Where was I? What was I lying about?
We're just talking about like how you got out and actually started performing in front of
crowds. Well, okay, I'll tell you. In 1957, my mother's sister came from visiting. People used to, in the summer, drive all over the country visiting their siblings, right? On two-lane roads.
Yeah.
So my mother's youngest sister came through from Lubbock. They'd been visiting some family there, and they lived in Cocoa Beach, Florida. Which is now, what is it? It's not Cocoa Beach. Well, whatever.
Right.
It's where they shoot the rockets off.
Right.
I was 17. And, I was actually 16, because that was in the summer, and I'm November. Anyway, let's say 17. Who gives a shit?
You
know?
You might have been 15. Nobody knows.
No, I wasn't 15.
Okay.
I know.
Okay.
Because they invited me to go back and spend a couple of weeks in Florida with them. Mm. And I had, at that point, I'd been to Oklahoma once and New Mexico once.
A well-traveled man.
Hey, get around a lot. Anyway, so I went home with them. And it was great. And right across the street lived two sisters. And they talked me into letting them dye my hair jet black. Mm. And I did. And, you know, I wasn't chasing girls really at that time. I mean, I loved girls, but I was not a, you know, I wasn't hustling the girls across the street.
Shy.
Yeah. And amazed at the magic of life.
You know? Sure.
So they lived right almost on the beach, a block away from the beach. My aunt was one of my biggest fans. And they had at the Starlight Lounge, which was where all the astronauts hung out. I didn't know this at the time. Every Wednesday night they had a talent show. And the last Wednesday of the night of the month, all the previous winners come back and they pick a winner. Well, my aunt rented me a guitar, a little Martin from a music store. And I went down there and did, well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you, you know. And I won.
Really?
And this woman from Columbia Records rushed up to me and she says, handed me her card and said, I want to make a record with you.
No way.
Yeah.
That's like the dream fantasy.
Exactly. And that's what I thought. I said, shit, I got it made.
Yeah. You're like, that was easy.
Again. Anyway, she rented me that guitar and I won that $100, which was it still is a lot of money until you have to break it and then it's gone.
Wait, so did that lead to you getting a record?
Yes, when I got back home, I knew a guy that had a snare drum, a hi-hat, and a rap cymbal. And we both wanted to make music. I knew another guy that played terrible saxophone, but he was the only one I knew. And he was willing. We played the very first night Jerry Lee Lewis ever played the Sportatorium in Dallas, 1957, with Great Balls of Fire.
Yeah.
Me and my band that couldn't play at all were the opening act.
No.
We had four guitar players. Nobody could play.
Did you get any feedback that night from the killer?
No, man. But he kicked it after we were done. The Sportatorium is a wrestling place, mainly known for wrestling matches. Yeah. Been there forever. So when they started doing shows, they just take the poles and the ropes down and set up. So it's square stage, and it's, you know, you're right there and you're leaning on it. Well, I was right there, and Lee Lewis is right here, and I'm watching. The minute he stood up and kicked that thing, man, and it went right by me. And it was the biggest thrill of my life.
Yeah, yeah. Showmanship lessons.
I said, good Jesus.
Yeah.
I don't know, did I leave anything out?
Well, okay, so that was like what year? That's the late 50s?
That was 57
right.
that happened, because when Great Balls of Fire came out.
Okay, so how did you go from that to playing like the harmonica part Bruce Channel song?
I was underage, which really didn't much matter in Fort Worth at that time. I mean, it was still pretty much the Wild West.
Right.
But, you know, they let you play, but you'd have to stay over in this booth when you take a break.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing. And no drinking, but, you know.
Right, sure. Wink, wink, wink. I remember I played my first gig in a bar when I was 16. And all my friends had to wait outside. I just looked through the door, and I remember I got done, and I put my guitar down, and I went over, and I just sat at the bar. I didn't try to order a beer. I was 16.
Just being there.
And the bartender popped open a bottle of beer and set it down in front of me, and I was like, what the fuck? I made it! And I remember I drank that thing, and I set it down empty, and he grabbed it, and he grabbed another one. And I was like, I really fucking made it.
Well, you cross a lot of thresholds in those days,
yeah.
You know?
And, yeah, you got to learn young.
You do.
Yeah.
Or you don't at all, pretty much.
Well, so what happened with the record deal from the lady in Cocoa Beach?
I never heard from her.
Oh, okay. So how did you wind up playing?
Well, I went home and started a band.
Right.
The Mellow Fellows. And nobody could play. The night that we went and did the thing with Jerry Lee, the guy that had a few pieces of a drum kit went to a hawk shop and got him a bass drum. So he had a snare, bass drum, hi-hat, and a ride cymbal.
Right.
So, you know. I backed up there. So what was I talking about?
About how you wound up playing harmonica on the Bruce
Johnson. Oh, okay.
But
well,
I like this stuff better.
Okay, all through the 60s, I had the best band in town.
Right.
Which is like being the world's tallest.
Was it the same guys?
Midget.
Like, did you guys learn how to play together?
I beg your pardon?
Was it the same guys that couldn't play? That guy, did everybody
no.
Get
that
better?
That didn't. My brother was one of them.
Okay.
And he never learned to play. He wanted to, but he didn't. In fact, by the time he was an old man, if he picked up a guitar, he'd still fumble at the same D chord or something, you know? And anyway, that's...
Well, that's why he's not a Lifetime Achievement honoree this week, man.
Well, he's dead, too. Thank you.
Is it true that you taught John Lennon how to play harmonica?
Man, you know...
Is that an internet myth, or is that the truth?
No, I'll tell you exactly what it is. Right now, it's a golden myth.
Right.
In proportion.
When Bruce Chanel
had number one song in England, he'd been doing these... Back then, everybody didn't have a band.
Right.
Everybody, all the artists that had hits did their song with a band that's put together.
Right.
Right, you know what I'm
right.
saying?
Like a pickup band.
Yeah, well, yeah. Huge, you know, orchestra, black, right. 10 guys.
Right.
Horn section, you know.
Right.
What was I telling you?
About teaching John Lennon how to play harp.
Well, Bruce hated that because the horns were doing the harp part. Mm. And it's not the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, okay, but I want Delbert to go. He wanted a harmonica, you know. He caught a lot of flack because where's the harmonica?
You sure.
Know? It's kind of
the hook in
it's
the song.
It's the hook of the song. Yeah. So, can y'all see me good enough? Bruce, that's better this way. So my first airplane trip was midnight flight out of Dallas on a twin engine, whatever they had back then. There were jets around, but this wasn't one of them. Anyway, midnight flight to New York, and once again, New Mexico and Oklahoma.
Yeah.
So I was thrilled out of my mind.
Sure.
So got to New York, and it was during the garbage strike. It felt like a rat.
Well-timed.
A rat in a tunnel to right. go anywhere. Because you can't see over the trash. It's just a tunnel.
Anyway. Your rat hunting skills probably came in handy at that point.
they had a heyday. Anyway, so we caught flight the next morning to London. And, you know, the London of my dreams was... I grew up and all I ever heard about was World War II.
Right.
And I'm a big... I've read 1,000 books about it. It's something that I really enjoy. So we were flying above the clouds in the sun, and they said we're making our descent, and we started hitting these clouds, and they got heavier, and they got heavier. And when we got out to where we could see, it was the London of my dreams, a drizzling, rainy day. And man, I like lost it. I thought it was some kind of magic. Anyway, that was the first big thrill of that trip.
Right.
So we landed, and then getting in the car where the steering wheel was novel, you know, because I'm sitting there going, oh, shit. You know? Anyway.
I still feel like that in a London cab, man.
I do too, man. It's just not right.
Yeah.
And you'll get your ass run over.
Yeah.
You look the other way.
Yeah.
Before you walk. Anyway, everybody knows about that. So we got there, and I got there a day before Bruce. So the cab took us to the hotel. We got in, and the first thing I noticed was that I left my harps in the cab. Mm. It's the only reason I was there.
Whoops.
And so I started getting real nervous, and somebody at the desk says, oh, no problem. Horner manufacturing plant about, you know, 2 miles this way. went over there and got everything I needed. Got back to the hotel, and the front desk said, cab driver came and dropped these off. So I was loaded, man, overloaded. So first 2 weeks over there, we were doing Granada theaters, you know, like old Fox theaters here, ornate, huge. Yeah. We were doing those, and there'd be about 10 acts on the show. That's where I met Johnny Kidd and the Pirates and Joe Brown and the Brothers.
So it was like a package tour?
Yeah.
Nice.
A Bruce Chanel show. Yeah. With, and so, how long we got?
Oh, I think we have like an hour. What? Oh. We doing good on time? Who's in charge here?
How much of that we got
left? We got 10 minutes left? Oh. Oh, for real? God, we're burning through it.
Well, I better
okay,
not
we
start
got 10
that
minutes.
Yeah. Take longer.
Keep going. Tell the John Lennon story.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was thinking about another one. Okay, so every night over there, you know, I'd been playing harp for a while and didn't realize until I got over there that people thought it was quite unique.
Right.
So every night, somebody from one of the other bands would come to the dressing room with a harmonica and say, how do you do that? Of course, you can't show anybody that.
Right.
Showing somebody on a harp, it's kind of like masturbation. You fool around with it, you figure it out.
Usually very much alone.
Well, that's where you woodshedding, baby.
That's what it's designed for.
So the
did
next...
Did you give him some tips on harmonica?
Yeah. So the next couple of weeks, we were doing club dates.
Hmm.
And the Castle in New Brighton, are you familiar with that place? Right across on the Mersey.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's where I saw them first.
Okay.
They opened the Bruce Chanel show.
Oh, really? What year was this? This must have been a very
62.
Young Beatles.
62.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Pete Best was drunk.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
So this was way before they had broken America.
Well, a couple of years or a year, you know.
Yeah.
Before they changed the world.
Yeah.
So
did they strike you as something special?
They were special, but I heard a lot of special.
Sure.
Rolling Stone magazine hadn't even come out yet.
Right.
They were people walking down the street in London with gig bags on, kiosks with 8 or 10 music magazines.
Right.
That wasn't happening here.
Right.
It was your hit parade, your favorite lyrics and what color they like best.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
That was impressive. And I said, this is where I need to be.
Sure.
Anyway, one night, that night, John came in and we shot the breeze. We got off pretty good, you know? In fact, we were off one night in London and he came by and picked me up. I mean, him and a couple of his friends, and took me out and introduced me to the devil.
Where did you meet the devil?
In a lot of dark alleys in London. And I you just use your imagination and you got it.
So they were already pretty wild.
Well,
by
the
then.
Whole scene over there was pretty wild.
Right.
You know, they...
But we're a few years out from, the swing in London at that point, right?
Well, swing in London, and you think about Berlin. Berlin in the 20s was the most decadent place on earth.
Sure.
And those guys spent a lot of time in Berlin and back and forth, and that area was a lot of black.
Right.
A lot of tight pants. A lot of...
Leather.
A lot of leather. And a lot of talent.
Right.
And it was all dangerous.
Yeah.
That's what was fun. It was dangerous.
I mean, did you sort of hone your craft in a similar way, like just playing endless 10-hour sets and in that same way that whether it's the Beatles or Buck Owens or whoever it is, it's like, you know, that's like a classic tale from that time.
Well,
probably why that generation of artists are so much, I don't know, stronger or more proficient or whatever than we are today.
You know, man, we talk about this forever because
right.
Back then in my youth and doing that, it was hard to to go down and or punch a button and hear a song that you had heard somebody do off somewhere in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
You can do it today. You had to hunt for it.
Sure.
And you had to live that life.
Yeah.
You had to be where that kind of thing went on.
Yeah.
I love that. That's where I live. I thought it was all about working six nights a week. You know?
Yeah.
Couldn't wait to do it every night. And then on
well, that's the funny thing in those years when you're paying your dues. You're not really thinking that at the time. You're just like,
well, no,
I can't believe I get to do this.
I got a gig.
Yeah.
And it was 12 o'clock closing law, you know? So four nights a week, no, it was another play, just three nights a week, we'd play Southside, what's the name of it? Doesn't matter. After Hours Club, great big joint. And I knew every pimp and whore and hustler and thief in town. And this place was common ground.
Yeah.
All the outlaws, and there were a lot of, everybody had a gun.
Right.
Pistol. And this was common ground. This was where everybody could come. Just don't start any shit. if you have trouble with somebody, take it somewhere else.
Right.
So it was, in effect, a safe place.
Right.
Huh. There was some, the people you meet at 4 a.m. in an after-hours club have got a stare going.
Yeah.
That it'd burn you if you they look at you too long.
You never really make great decisions at 4 a.m. in an after-hours club, I've found.
Well, I can give you the best example of that.
Hit me.
I don't think my wife knows this either, but this is...
Now we're getting into the shit.
Well, I was a speed freak, too.
Okay.
You know, so, you know, I don't know if you know what that does.
I've heard of that.
Well, it turned you into God for a little while,
right.
And then the devil for a week.
A long while, yeah.
Anyway, no, I'm not going to tell that story. It's funny, it's sad, and it may be dangerous.
All right, well, we can connect the dots on that one. Before we're about to run out of time, there was something I really wanted to get to. If we could just take a left turn. I think the first record that you did, the first record deal you had was for Delbert and Glenn, right?
No.
No, it was not. Okay, well, can we talk about that first record you guys did together?
The first record we did together.
Yeah, because that is considered... like an extremely influential record a lot of your records are, but that one in particular out of your catalog is really like a very influential record in this world of Americana. You know, like I think I was telling you beforehand, when the first time I ever recorded anything with Dave Cobb, that was one of the first things he gave me was a copy of that record.
Really?
It was like, you got a vibe on this, like check this out, this is the shit.
Oh, that's cool, man.
And I know that a lot of people, like that's a record that gets passed around in this world of America.
Well, good.
So could you talk about that? Like, how did that come about?
Well, it came about... Glenn Clark, who briefly, he was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years younger than me. He and a friend of his used to come to our rehearsals when he was a little guy, when I was a teenager.
So you knew him from Texas?
Oh, yeah. I've known him since he was 8 or 9 years old.
Right.
And then by the time he got, he grew up and he's a singing son of a bitch. Good B3 player, good piano player. So we started working together in downtown.
Yeah.
And he got out. He moved to California.
Right.
Another friend of ours, a drummer that I had a band with, had been living out there in Topanga for some time. He kept saying, you guys need to come out of here. You guys need to come
it's
out
hopping.
Here. And we were, and I was married in a terrible, unhappy marriage and stuck in a town, a life I hated. So I had to make a decision, so I left. Hmm. I mean, we were already separated and all that stuff, but I left. Here's how I left. I was playing this beer joint one night, and this woman comes in that I had known for years and hadn't seen her in years, and she looked great. And she just got a divorce and a 66 Chrysler Imperial and a pocket full of money. And I said, hey, you want to go to California? And so we went to California. That's where two more bottles of wine came from.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
And so we got out there, and like I said, they lived in Topanga Canyon, which, yeah, you know, it's...
Sure.
Well, they had a house, and then they had this kind of storage area down on with dirt floors. Well, had a big old mattress, a queen-size mattress on the dirt floor.
Yeah.
When we got there, we'd been driving 2 days, so we all needed a shower. Well, they're on septic. So he and his wife were sometime bathing the same water, they told me, trying to keep it from overrunning.
Right.
Well, we didn't know that, you know. We went in there and took showers and before they could stop us. So later that night, I woke up down there on that mattress to go take a whiz, and we were floating.
In septic water?
Welcome to California.
That's a bad scene. Oh, no.
My shoes, my clothes, everything. No, I did have my clothes up hanging off.
Oh, no.
Put them in the dirt. But anyway, but you know, we were hungry, and that was cool. It was okay.
Yeah.
Anything's okay when you're hungry.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it'll pass.
Right. You know?
But
we were talking about the record you made.
Well, Glenn and I, oddly, didn't write a lot of songs together. We wrote songs, mostly he wrote some and I wrote some.
Right, right.
But we sing so good together.
Sure.
His voice is the perfect voice to sing with me.
Right.
And so we just had a whole lot of fun. We were doing that record on spec at Paramount Studio in Hollywood. And, you know, we go in and do it. If it sells anything, we pay for the studio. That's the deal we had. And Earl McGrath, who's a big buddy with Ahmet Erdogan,
yeah,
was in the studio one night, and he heard what we were doing and wanted to sign us to a record. He was starting a new record company called Clean Records. And the label was a hand with a bar of soap in
it. After your night in the septic tank, that probably sounded pretty good.
We were stepping up. It was obvious.
Yeah.
He's big friend with Ahmet Erdogan, you know.
Yeah.
And he wanted to start a record company, and Ahmet said, "Well, I'll distribute for you." They're big buddies.
Yeah.
And did you know Ahmet Erdogan?
I mean, I knew who.
Well, Earl McGrath, the guy's on. He's one. He was an amazing guy. Ahmet depended on him. He had a party once for this real short friend of theirs, and hired every midget they could find so that he'd be the tallest guy in the room.
That's a good friend.
Yeah, and his parties, he would invite the most people that you'd have no idea why they were even alive.
Right, right, right.
And it always worked so good. Anyway, he wanted to sign us up, so we signed the Clean Records for $1,000 a piece. I was 31 years old, and it was more money than I'd ever held in my hand in my life.
Sure.
Got my teeth fixed.
Nice.
You're living in West Texas back then. You had to get your teeth fixed eventually, usually because the water would rust them, and your smile was just rust. Looked like peanut butter stuck on.
Really?
My brother had it real bad. He finally got his fixed too, but the first thing I did was get my teeth fixed because I was doing this all the time. I couldn't smile or laugh. Oh, really?
You make your living with your smile, man. Gotta have a good grill. Exactly.
I'm ready. Anyway, we did that record. We got booked on a month-long tour opening for John Mayall. That we never got paid for.
Right.
Yeah, they were going to pay us at the end. Some English guy, promoter, was doing, I can't even remember his name now. That's probably good because it just made me think what an asshole he was again. But we never got paid, and you know, that wasn't the first time.
Right.
Anyway, that's what we did. We made that record, and then we made another one, and we weren't drifting apart as friends, but we wanted to do different things.
Yeah. How was it when you guys got back together
It was like we'd never been apart.
What was the gap between those records? Like 40 years or something?
40 years. Yeah. It was like, that record is blind, crippled, and crazy.
You know, your second record together is not in Spotify and all those streaming services. Because somebody needs to sort that out.
Well, somebody is going to have to do it.
it's not going to be you. That's what you're saying.
You know, I don't care anymore. I want to be quiet when I want to be quiet.
Right.
And I want to do what I want to do. And I can't be in a room with more than five people at a time if they're talking.
Yeah, except all of you folks. You folks are cool. Well, you know, we're coming to the end here. I'm curious, you know, was there ever a time between, you know, the early success and first starting out and all that?
You know, coming to the end is not a good thing to say to somebody my age.
We're just coming to the end of this, and it's funny because I got a lot more questions that I ran out of time here. So you got to promise me that you're going to come back to my podcast again sometime.
I would love to.
So I can really finish the, because we didn't get into all kinds of good stuff.
I even
here.
Like it.
Right. I mean, what I was going to say was, this is my last question for you, was there ever a time between starting out and the buzz of being, you know, young and just first in the industry to, like, you know, all through, in those middle years, was there ever a time you thought about hanging it up? You know, like when you're just grinding it out, like before, between the early years and the lifetime achievement honoree, you know, man that you are today.
Let me answer that this way. I didn't go to Vietnam because I was 3A. I had a child in 61. I didn't. My first wife did. And so I didn't have to go to do that. I can remember getting ready to go to the gig, zipping up my Beetle boots, watching the news of today in Vietnam. It's insane.
Right.
It's on television all the time.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's a pretty weird place to be. What was I telling you?
Well, we were talking about, like, you know, if there was ever a point.
Oh,
you know,
okay. I don't know. So I had to have jobs. I had to have day jobs.
Right.
I was not educated. I like a half credit graduating English in high school. If I don't play music, I'd have to go to work.
Mm. Yikes.
I went to work, and the kind of jobs I could get was driving a hotshot delivery truck for a brake and clutch replacement shop, or Stratoflex, trying to put together high pressure hoses for aircraft from 11 o'clock. I'd get off the gig, leave the gig at 10:30, and go to work at the fighter factory at 11 o'clock.
Right. So basically, jobs that were nowhere near as fun as playing music for a living.
I can't do anything else. You know, I can sit and lie to you all day long with the best of them and talk shit and play music and go on. But, and I can talk all you want to about World War II history, about psychedelics, and how I think there's something so important there that it's beyond imagination. Mm. But it's coming. Anyway.
Well, you heard it here first. Delbert McClinton says everybody should take acid.
No, I'm not. That's not what I'm saying.
That's
at
a
all.
Good place to end this thing. I'm just kidding. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Delbert McClinton. This has been amazing. Thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You got a crazy week. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Delbert McClinton. Yes, that was Mr. Delbert McClinton, Lifetime Achievement Award winning legendary artist Delbert McClinton. You know what to do. Go to my website, walkingthefloor.com. I'm going to put some links up so you can see where Delbert's at. The man's always working, touring hard, making records, doing whatever, and go check him out. And that's it for this week. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. Not sure with who. I've got a few good ones in the can to select from. As a matter of fact, I interviewed Pokey LaFarge again today. But I'm not going to put that one out just quite that yet. But we'll see. We'll see. I'm going to rummage through my pile of interviews and see which one to throw at you 2 weeks from today. All right, thank you so much. Adios, amigos.